Well, what, for longer than you might think, it worked. It's not that we can... We always talk about the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. I think we sort of want to deny that this was a functioning system because we have all these images of how horrible the Romans were, how decadent the society was, how awful they were. And we want to say, this is nothing like us. This is something that couldn't ever possibly have functioned. We can distance ourselves from the greed and the horribleness of these Romans. They were ancient. They were not like us. And I think we need to remind ourselves that, in fact, they were very much like us, and that the Roman Empire went on much longer than modern U.S. imperial powers has been going on so far. I don't know if our society is going to last as long as the Roman Empire did.
Yeah, well, I suppose you could say Rome didn't fall in a day or whatever. But
exactly, yes.
But things seem to be falling apart very... Maybe things just happen faster in our modern times, but I don't know.
Yeah.
It's so it's just... tell us a little bit about Seneca's death. He was finally tracked down, he was caught, and he was forced to kill himself. But he didn't do very well at that either, did he?
He didn't do very well at that either. No, So he was forced to kill himself. The news came that Nero was accusing him of conspiracy and of trying to kill him. So it was clear that he was going to have to kill himself. He went through a number of different suicide methods. First, he summoned all his friends around him. He had his wife as well, who wanted to kill herself alongside him. And he wanted to dictate his last words, his last speeches to his friends. So it was a very, very public and self-dramatizing kind of death. He tried drinking hemlock, which is, of course, what Socrates did to kill himself. So it's the appropriate kind of death for a philosopher. But it didn't work, because he was too wizened and shriveled up. But it's possible also that the dose was wrong. But he tried to cut his wrists and also cut his ankles to bleed to death. Again, that didn't work. And then eventually he got into a hot bath so that the steam would open up the veins more and help to suffocate him. And finally he did die. But there's a long and really very funny account in Tacitus of how difficult it was for Seneca to do this thing which he'd been writing about all his life, which is dying.
Oh, my. Well, I think we'll end. What a way to end an interview. But anyway, we want to thank you very much. We've been talking with Professor Emily Wilson, who wrote this book, The Greatest Empire, A Life of Seneca, the speechwriter for Emperor Nero. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for the conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, and this has been Fight the Empire, and stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station.
Oh, yes, it is KBOO Portland, and a bit of a topsy-turvy day here on the radio. That recorded program starting a bit late, so we're going to launch right into Air Cascadia with Chris Andre. So stick around. That is coming up next in Flashpoints in about 15 minutes from now. You are listening to KBOO Portland.
Cascadia. Today is Thursday, March 19th, 2015. And you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. Our guest this morning, Francis Boyle, is a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law. He has served as a legal advisor to the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, and his books include The Palestinian Right of Return Under International Law. We have a couple headlines that we want to just touch upon before we speak with Dr. Boyle. As many people already know, the Portland Law Review Commission has unanimously rejected the proposed Haven Energy propane export terminal this week, just the other day on Tuesday. Concerns, public concerns around the community about the safety and the true economic impact of the $300 million project. When they say $300 million, that doesn't mean that $300 million is going to be pumped back into the local economy. It's more likely that $300 million will be pumped out of the community. The jobs generated, the high-paying jobs in pretty much every case with these energy companies, the high-paid jobs don't go to local people because local people don't have the very specific skills needed. So what happens is that they bring in their people from outside the project, and those people get the high-paid jobs, and when the project is finished and up and running and all that, then those people go move on to the next target and take the money with them. The low-paid jobs are not necessarily permanent. Very often they're not, the construction ones in any case. And the other ones are low-paid jobs who go to low-skilled local workers. The profits from all of this, in case you were wondering what happened to that, all of that gets pumped out to the originating multinational company. And that's the long story. It's a long walk off a very short pier. And anyone who takes that walk would be incredibly foolish. For one thing, it could blow up in any place along the way. On that note, however, and in the backdrop of the Oso landslide anniversary coming up, we'll be doing a special on that tomorrow, the most detailed published scientific account of the mudslide, which is the deadliest in U.S. history, suggests the disaster was years in the making in a valley with a history of huge landslides, and in all likelihood, it was man-made. No big surprise there. More headlines? Check out the Air Cascadia slot on the KBOO website. And right now, I am delighted to welcome back, actually, to the KBOO airwaves, our guest today, Dr. Francis Boyle, professor, as I said, of international law and the author of a terrific book. Whether or not we're supposed to do this or not, I do want to urge you, have a look at the Palestinian Right of Return Under International Law. Good morning, Dr. Boyle. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, Chris, thank you for having me on again, and my best to your listening audience.
Well, this is wonderful. This is really interesting, isn't it? Sometimes people say things that they it's like hitting the send button and then saying, uh-oh, because Netanyahu really did hit the send button after he said that he did not support a two-state solution. A one-state solution would put the Palestinians in the majority, quite likely. But I don't think that that's what he had in mind. I think he had in mind Palestinians becoming refugees, no longer in their own land, but in other lands, like so many people in the Middle East today. What do you make of his remarks?
Right. Well, I think any of us who've dealt with the Middle East peace negotiations knew that Netanyahu was never serious about a two-state solution, that he and his cohorts and supporters want all of Palestine for Israel, including the West Bank and Jerusalem, and with as few Palestinians as possible. And if that at an opportune moment means ethnically cleansing the Palestinians out of Palestine, he will do it. The sad part is that he did this just before the election, and the Israeli people supported him. He did this to appeal for 4 votes, and on the basis of that claim, that statement, the Israeli people voted him back in office. So it's a sad sign that apparently the Israeli people themselves are no longer interested in a two-state solution and put him back in office. It's a low point between you and me, but there it is. That's what we have to deal with.
Yeah, and one way that many people, certainly on the left, liberal side of things here, is the idea of the boycott, divest, and sanctions movement, which so far has generated plenty of talk, but not much has actually happened. What chance do you think that this boycott, divest, and sanctions movement has of making any sort of having any sort of impact at all?
Well, now it's one of the few hopes we have, Chris. As a matter of fact, I called for the Israeli divestment disinvestment campaign publicly in November 2000, and then in 2005, Palestinian civil society leaders contacted me and said, you know, we'd like to expand this to boycott and sanctions along the line of what was done to apartheid South Africa. Would you be willing to go in with us? And I said, sure. So it became the BDS movement, but technically I'm D in BDS. And as I saw it in November 2000 when I called for it, here in the United States, Congress is completely under control of Zionist sources, as you see. The mainstream news media as well, the executive branch of government. And so as I saw it back in 2000 when I called for this to be set up, we had to take our case out to the American people for Palestine and Palestinian human rights. In my belief that the common sense and judgment of principles of the American people would realize the validity of the Palestinian claims, and that by means of divestment, disinvestment, now BDS, this would slowly take off all over the country, like the South African divestment, disinvestment campaign did, and gradually percolate up there from the people into Washington, D.C. So that's what's happening now as we speak, not only here in the United States, but internationally as well. And now that, you know, Netanyahu has made it perfectly clear where he stands, this is only going to give a fill-up to the BDS movement around the world.
Well, it is something that we tend to forget is that perhaps we'd like to see a lot more momentum in this country, but in other countries the momentum is there and people are seriously engaging in this program. And now, I mean, it seems like immediately, in fact, during the election, people here were talking about this very seriously and thinking along these lines, is that this is it. This is our only option at this point. Things for the Palestinians, it is very similar to apartheid. There are differences, and of course, then as now, Israel is a nuclear armed state, so that
apartheid South Africa was nuclear armed too.
Yeah, but thanks to the Israelis.
Right, but both were nuclear armed and major superpowers, and eventually the international grassroots campaign of divestment, disinvestment had a very important role in overthrowing the apartheid regime in South Africa, and I think the same will happen here. It will take longer. I remember I joined the anti-apartheid campaign against South Africa at Harvard Law School about 1974, and when I came out here in 1978, it appeared like we were tilting at windmills, but eventually apartheid did fall in South Africa, and I think for the same reason the apartheid regime in Israel will fall as well. It's going to take longer, but I think it's inevitable for the same reasons.
That's about it as far as time. Any sources you would recommend? Any just very brief final thoughts on the subject?
Right. Well, I discussed the Israeli divestment disinvestment campaign that I set up in two of my books, Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law, that was published in 2003. And then I updated it in a second book, Breaking All the Rules. And that came out in about 2010. And then my latest book, The Palestinian Right of Return. So, you know, if you get those three books, they should have everything.
That's it. We highly recommend this. We're completely out of time. I just wanted to say my guest's latest piece, Netanyahu Victory, opens door for one state solution. On that note, this has been Air Cascadia for Thursday, March 19th, 2015. Our engineer today is Roch Bergeron. Kathy Stevenson is the KBOO AM News Public Affairs Director. Thanks, Roch, for that. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.